Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for this week in enterprise tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT. This week in enterprise tech, episode 292, recorded May 25th, 2018. Logic Hub and Women in Technology. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Slack. Slack is a collaboration hub for your work that makes sure the right people in your team are always in the loop and key information is always at their fingertips. Learn more at slack.com. And by Duo Security. Give anytime, anywhere access to applications based on the trustworthiness of users and devices with Duo Beyond, the zero trust security platform. Sign up for a free trial at duo.com. And by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so you can be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host for today, Louis Maresca, your guide through the enterprise world, but I definitely do not want to guide you by myself. I need a little help from my friend, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Another good one today, Curtis. Mirai is back in the news. How are you doing?
Well, doing pretty well. So far, I don't have anything infected by Mirai, but it does give me lots to write about. So a good day in every direction.
Fantastic. And of course, we cannot do without Mr. Brian G. Gbert, I hear you're dropping switches in the ocean and building touchscreen Raspberry Pis now.
Yeah, in fact, yeah, here's my little touchscreen Raspberry Pi. It's a little resistive touchscreen. So you can use a finger or a stylus. And I'm going to be making a tiny little network diagnostic tool for the field, try and get the price down so that third world countries and small schools can afford some handheld network diagnostics.
Awesome, awesome. I need some new hobbies. You guys do so much more interesting stuff than I do. Well, guys, we have a great show for today. We're going to talk a little bit about facial recognition, GDPR. We also have a great guest to talk about security ops and women in tech. But first, we wouldn't be TWiT without getting into the blips. Let's jump into it. So today is the day. Is your organization ready for business in the EU? Well, GDPR, or the General Data Protection Rules, are now in effect. Remember that thing? Well, 2 years ago, it was proposed that people doing business in the EU need to give the power of the user's data back to the user. Such rules as the idea of the right to be forgotten. The law holds provisions that could potentially increase consumers' rights over their data. What happens if you don't comply? Well, you could be fined up to 4% of global turnover or 20 million euros, whichever is greater. Does this actually create a level playing field for data? Well, Instapaper actually had a shutdown in the EU due to not being GDPR compliant. And that kind of hurts a little bit for their business. Companies are also worried that even though they campaigned to actually be ready for this, they have no idea that if they implemented the rules the right way. This hits small companies or even small organizations fairly hard. Even small sports clubs in Berlin have had membership data and photos of their players, and they have to comply as well. Take a look at your inbox over the last week. You probably have a rash amount of emails talking about privacy changes and their compliance with the rules. Is it just the wool over our eyes, or do you think that these companies are actually ready? Well, we'll see over the coming months and how the EU will go to uphold the law. We're already seeing Facebook and Google being targeted with GDPR complaints. The complaints could result in more than $3 billion in fines for each company. I have a good feeling the EU is going to start targeting some organizations to make an example out of them, to strike the fear in the rest to comply. Only the time will tell.
Well, third parties are your source for the most expensive data breaches. Kaspersky Lab recently polled 6,614 business decision makers on their IT security spending, the types of threats they've faced, and the cost of recovering from cyber attacks. They found the cost of breaches has grown by more than one-fifth for both enterprises and small to mid-sized businesses, and the price tag is only expected to get larger. The cost is growing faster for the smaller victims. Average enterprise pays $1.23 million per incident, which is up about 24% from 2017. The small businesses, though, spend about $120,000 per incident, an increase of 36% from last year. Improving software and infrastructure is the most expensive part of a breach for enterprises, followed by repairing damage to credit rating, insurance premiums, and training. Third-party providers are the source of the costliest incidents, researchers report, with the top five affecting enterprises, including targeted attacks, incidents affecting IT infrastructure hosted by a third party, incidents involving non-computing connected devices, third-party cloud services, and data leaks from internal systems. A security expert reviewed the results, saying that companies could benefit from more spending on visibility and unification as they deploy more tools across their data centers in the public cloud, which leads to poor visibility and noise and detracts from their ability to control security.
Well, it seems a small group of iOS developers are trying to form a developers union to push for App Store changes. So anyway, this Ars Technica article reads, a small group of developers for Apple platforms has banded together to request new features and policies from Apple, and its members say they have ideas for ways to make it easier to actually make a living on the platform. Wired also reports they're calling it the Developers Union, and they launched a website where devs can sign up to share their support of a free trial feature for the App Store. The group's founders say they will start with the free trial push, but that it will follow that with other community-driven, developer-friendly changes, including a more reasonable revenue cut. The starting revenue share is 70-30 in the developer's favor presently. Google offers a similar rate, but Microsoft recently announced a cut to its shares of revenue to developers' favor. Well, let's hope when the push comes to shove, this type of coalition could perhaps start a second mobile app developer gold rush.
So remember Kaspersky's lab and the allegations against the company that were linked to Russian intelligence? Well, Kaspersky denies such links, but there are other companies that in order to sell in the Russian market, tech companies including Hewlett-Packard, SAP, and McAfee have allowed a Russian defense agency to scour software source code for vulnerabilities. In this climate, risk mitigations are going into effect. This past week, a new bill, National Defense Authorization Act, has a new source code disclosure rule. If passed into law, the legislation requires companies that do business in the U.S. military to disclose any source code review of the source of software being done by adversaries. The details of the foreign source code reviews and any steps that the company agreed to take to reduce the risks would be stored in a database accessible by military officials. This also is in the midst of an investigation that found software makers allowing a Russian defense agency to hunt for vulnerabilities in software that was already deeply embedded in some of the most sensitive parts of the U.S. government, including the Pentagon, the FBI, and intelligence agencies. Security experts say allowing Russian authorities to conduct the reviews of internal software instructions could help Russia find vulnerabilities and more easily attack key systems that protect the United States. Well, the new cybersecurity war has begun, and the government is not going to take any chances.
Mirai is back, and this time it's wicked. Researchers at Fortinet recently found a new variation on the old IoT botnet malware Mirai, which they have dubbed Wicked Mirai. The new variation is named for a string in the code that seems to point back to the hacker responsible for the new variant. In looking at the code, they found malware that scans multiple ports on network devices and then uses open ports to download copies of different payloads depending on which ports are available. Once on a system, Wicked Mirai contacts a CNC server from which it downloads another payload, which seems to include something from the Sora, Awari, and Omni Mirai variant families. It's really hard to say what the payload is for certain, because it's evolving and changing on a nearly daily basis. Wicked has added IoT persistence to its toolkit, making the malware part of the IoT devices it infects beyond the occasional reboots seen in some IoT networks. The Wicked evolution of Mirai has a simple purpose. Bottom line is that this allows the botnet controllers to have a faster compromise time, which in the end allows for the botnet to come online and start being profitable even faster.
In a similar vein, hackers have infected half a million consumer routers all over the world with malware called VPN Filter and can survive reboots and even contains a destructive kill function. Hackers possibly working for an advanced nation have infected more than half a million home and small office routers around the world with malware that can be used to collect communications, launch attacks on others, and permanently destroy the devices with a single command, researchers at Cisco warned last Wednesday. VPN Filter, as the modular multi-stage malware has been dubbed, works on consumer-grade routers made by Linksys, Microtik, Netgear, TP-Link, and on network-attached storage devices from QNAP. Cisco researchers said in an advisory recently, it's one of the few pieces of Internet of Things malware that can survive a reboot. Infections in at least 54 countries have been slowly building since at least 2016, and Cisco researchers have been monitoring them for several months. The attacks drastically ramped up during the past 3 weeks, including two major assaults on devices located in the Ukraine. The spike, combined with the advanced capabilities of the malware, prompted Cisco to release Wednesday's report before the research is fully completed. Kind of makes me wish our friends at IDIS Networks that we interviewed back in episode 131 had survived, because this type of bad news has become all too commonplace in this day and age of poorly designed and poorly updated consumer security devices.
So blockchain continues to surface itself in our news streams and in the tech world. The technology is opening new doors to possible new financial systems that work over the internet, securely moving data and money across it. There's one limitation experts continue to point out, and that is that blockchains don't actually talk to each other. This means that blockchains are used in the wild more in a siloed or sandboxed approach from each other. This shuts the door on making cross uses of information and allowing for a microservice-like architecture. MIT's Connection Science program had an interesting metaphor that it's similar to the pre-internet days of the 60s and 70s, where each network was actually separate and there was only one approach to constructing them: disconnected. They need to share resources and communicate to each other. If we overlay this concept on the blockchain, that can be reinforced with more security and more reinforcement for failover. Imagine the ability to transfer crypto assets to different distributed chains if blockchains are attacked. This concept and more, outlined in the paper by Hardoino and the team out in this day's blockchain developers, and the fact that they should borrow the concept from the Internet Protocol Suite called the Datagram, which is a common unit of information that can move across different networks. A startup called Ion is working on and answering that question. The company is developing what is called a token bridge that will let holders of Ethereum-based tokens back to their assets on another blockchain initially, one built and run by Ion. This might add complexity to distributed systems, but it also reinforces that today's big data climate, systems have to evolve in order to stay ahead of the game. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. And next up, the Bytes. But first, we have to actually thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and it's Slack. You know, if you haven't used Slack before, it literally is the collaboration hub for your work, your group, and your team, whoever is trying to collaborate with. There are so many ways I've used Slack before. It allows me to bring together numerous groups in order to just organize the way we worked. I've actually seen IT and operation teams, as well as engineering and development, brought together in a set of channels that let everyone organize the conversations in real-time messaging. Plus, once video and voice calling was added to Slack, as well as file sharing, and then the ability to go back and search and gain historical context, it brought a rich environment for keeping people up to date with what was going on. You create a new channel for new issues, show alerts for real-time updates and channels, and because Slack can integrate to other systems, it brings that information to you, the collaboration hub. Slack keeps teams together and ensures that communication is efficient and it stays productive each and every step of the way. Imagine your sales team getting together on Slack. They can chat about the latest products in order to stay connected, as well as what educate them on what they're selling, and maybe even need to chat about new prospects or potentially even current clients. They can come back later and review everything. Slack just creates a place where everyone can stay up to date and ensure they don't miss anything. Having used Slack, I can tell you that there's some pretty great features out there. And one of them, one of the new ones I actually love quite a bit, and that's Slack Threads. Now you can take a conversation off to the side and start another thread without clotting that main conversation. Plus, searching for me is super simple. I can even make use of advanced search modifiers like in channels or from someone or before or after a date and a ton more. And that actually helps you narrow down and find exactly what you need. People of any generation have found ways to use Slack to increase their productivity, whether it's planning a reunion, handling different facets of an event, or supporting a product, or having your sales team keep in touch. Slack will just make it easier. There are tons of public communities and organizations on using Slack. In fact, I've joined dev chat and designers and UX spaces to chat about with my fellow industry experts. It's fun and it keeps me connected. Greater than 8 million daily users and more than 50,000 teams are using Slack every day. Not only that, Slack has a strong app ecosystem. Want more functionality and integrations? Well, there's Jira, Salesforce, Zendesk, and more. Over 1,000 apps. You want to integrate with your own system? Well, Slack actually is a super thriving developer community as well. Hook up those webhooks. It also works anywhere. It has iOS, Android, Windows, Mac apps that seamlessly sync where you can just pick up where you left off. Why is Slack an amazing sponsor of Twilio? Well, because Slack brings the collaboration to enterprise as well. With Slack Enterprise Grids, you can literally light up workplaces that can be linked together in shared channels, which allows people to take advantage of the entire graph of communication in an organization. They can even deploy organization-wide policies to maintain their company assurances. Slack reduces your emails, streamlines your communication, saves time, and increases your productivity. I can't say enough good things about Slack. With Slack, your team is better connected. Learn more at slack.com. That's slack.com. And we thank Slack for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, let's jump into the bites. Well, according to a six-month investigation by the ACLU, there's a new system called Recognition, which is put in use by a number of agencies across America, including the Police Department for Orlando, Florida, Washington County Sheriff's Office in Oregon. And in fact, it's a lesser-known system developed by Amazon. So let's talk a little bit about case studies. So this particular system uses AI in order to do facial recognition. The Washington County Sheriff's Office caught a hardware store thief by running his image through facial recognition system, finding four hits with 80% success rate. By cross-referencing them with individual pictures on Facebook, go figure, they found out that the same hoodie that the person was wearing was actually worn in the theft as well. Imagine that. Another one, there were surveillance cameras that were caught. They actually caught someone stealing a credit card and later found that it was found to be stolen, actually. And the probability was that they found a low-resolution photo of them, and it was actually at a weird angle. And not only that, but Amazon's recognition system found a 95% match for them. If you were one of the lucky blokes or women who watched the royal wedding last week, Sky News actually used this system and this technology to recognize guests. And get this, the system is super cheap. For almost 40,000 images processed, departments would have to only pay $30.99. So in this post published this past Tuesday, ACLU officials wrote the following. With recognition, a government can now build a system to automate the identification and tracking of anyone. If a police body camera, for example, were outfitted with facial recognition, devices intended for office transparency and accountability would further transform into surveillance machines aimed at the public. With this technology, police would be able to determine who attends protests. ICE could seek to continuously monitor immigrants as they embark on new lives. Cities might routinely track their own residents, whether they have reason to suspect criminal activity or not. And as with our surveillance technologies, these systems certain to be disproportionately aimed at minority communities. This creates a really interesting dynamic. Microsoft and others have been doing facial recognition longer than Amazon, but it seems Amazon is the first to commoditize it in a way. Or maybe they do it, they don't do it, and we simply just don't know about it. In fact, we saw that in Orlando, recognition is being used to find people of interest, quote unquote, using footage from cameras all over the city. So this is weird because it almost makes me feel like they're doing the same thing that China is doing as they surveil their entire country with millions and millions of cameras. So, Curtis, I actually want to throw this over to you first because you live in Orlando. Shouldn't we be told about this? Like, it sounds like it's just the beginning.
It does sound like the beginning. And yes, I think that the people of Orlando should have been told about this. And there are a lot of people in Orlando who feel the same way. The pages of the Orlando Sentinel, the paper of the city, have been filled with articles the last day or two since this news broke. A lot of comment. The broadcast news outlets are also looking at this. It's interesting because Orlando is a city where, in general, the police department has enjoyed a pretty good relationship with the population, although there have been, as in so many places, things that went wrong. Orlando embraced body cameras for officers pretty early, used them a lot. Orlando is in an interesting situation because of a couple of things. One is that we are a city where so many visitors come. I mean, we are home of the top tourist destinations in the country. So we have a lot of visitors to Orlando, even though technically much of the attraction is outside the city limits. The other is that we do have the legacy of the Pulse nightclub shooting, which was for an unfortunately brief time the largest mass shooting in our nation's history. The law enforcement is touchy. They try to stay on top of things. But I think what they've entered into now is a discussion with city government and with the residents about both just how far they should be going and how much information they should be giving to the populace as they try new things. Now, they've said that this is just a pilot program, basically just an experiment that they're running. Still, the privacy implications are such that a lot of people feel that they really should have been much more transparent about what they were doing with the residents of Orlando.
Right. So we balked a little bit at China for doing this to their citizens. Obviously, they're making it law. They're actually rating citizens on this. I want to throw it over to you, Cheaper. Is this even legal to do this here in the United States?
Well, obviously I'm not a lawyer, but they are at the moment, from what I understand, only using these in public areas, places that have, quote, no expectation of privacy. Now, keep in mind, there is lots of precedence for this. During very large sporting events, very large special events, there are cameras galore. If you start bringing in something like, let's talk London. London, rumors has the most CCTV coverage of any modern metropolitan area. Now, if you look at the other side of this, we are asking our police forces to do an awful lot more with less, especially with all these school shootings and so forth. We have asked them to go and find the bad guys faster, but we haven't been giving them giant leaps in budgets. I see this as a way of being able to leverage their people. What I would like to see them do, and this is obviously a policy issue, I want to make sure that there's some human intervention there. I would love to have the system go and say, hey, if I'm going to put out a Be On the Lookout or a Bolo for a yellow van with Bondo on the back quarter panel, I want to be able to go and show recognition, sample photos of a yellow van with Bondo on the quarter panel and have it go and look through a lot of cameras. And I would love to have them take the place of a huge number of people watching CCTV coverage to try and find that. Isn't it a better way to have a system to go and help narrow the search down so that our skilled and trained police can go and do something? Now, obviously, there's, you know, we can argue the skilled police back and forth, but the reality is I'm ex-law enforcement. And the reality is we never have enough eyes to look at video. We never have enough police on the street. I see this as a way of giving the general public the level of safety they want. I just hope that our policymakers make sure that there's policy to also make sure that this video isn't stored. You know, I want it to be eyes and ears. I don't want it to be Big Brother.
Right. Well, Amazon actually has responded to many civil rights groups and news outlets, and this is what they've said. And the utility of AI services like this will only increase as more companies start using advanced technologies like Amazon recognition. Our quality of life would be much worse today if we outlawed new technology because some people could choose to abuse the technology. Imagine if customers couldn't buy a computer because it was possible to use the computer for illegal purposes. Like any of our services, we require customers to comply with the law and be responsible when using Amazon recognition. Curtis, do they actually have a point here?
Well, I think that they do have a point, and that's what makes this tricky. I mean, we do things like in many states, there are red light cameras that catch people automatically if they run a red light. There are other automated camera things, and let's be realistic. A lot of people have sort of become used to the idea through television programs. If you look at any of the crime procedurals on television, at some point they're going to go looking for the traffic cameras or the surveillance cameras at companies along the way, the security camera at the local convenience mart, that sort of thing. So people are becoming used to the idea that if they are in a public place, their expectation of privacy is dramatically lower than it is if they're at home. I think that what we're still coming to grips with here is the idea of automating this in the same way that we had little problem as a society with police officers who parked their car in a parking lot and caught people as they went through a red light. And yet the idea that we would do this automatically with red light cameras seems somehow unsporting to us. Let's admit Americans have an interesting relationship with rules and the law. In this case, I think that it is going to bring in the notion of some automation, and we're going to have a discussion that we probably should have started having a few years ago. And it gets to join some other conversations we have around security. For example, the DNA testing that goes on with the people who want to find out where their ancestors came from. These publicly available DNA databases from people doing things like 23andMe or the National Geographic DNA database or the one from the big genealogy sites. How okay are we with this? And it really does get down to very basic questions about what privacy means in the 21st century and how willing we are to bend the notions of privacy if the result is greater security. It's a conversation that I suspect we're going to continue to have for quite some time to come.
Right. And, you know, 23andMe is an advertiser with us. But I want to throw it over to you, Chibert. I think that, you know, the interesting part here, going to what Curtis said and what you said before is, you know, people might be storing this data and they could be using it for other purposes. Like, you know, what if organizations actually threw a little bit of machine learning behind this to determine a possible threat possibility? So like, for instance, maybe they throw some bias towards you around some machine learning that's kind of behind that. And that creates more problems. So you not only are being recognized facially, but then also being scored potentially behind the scenes, whether you're likely to do the crime again or likely to actually have committed that crime. And that data is being stored and next time you get pulled over, maybe they'll look at you again. Is this something that we should be worried about?
I think it's something that we need to keep in mind. Let's actually bring up Ripple Rider in the chat room actually had a very good comment about mission creep. We may start off with the best of intentions, but sadly, the human race has this really nasty habit of having some really big variability in how people do things. And so I think we, the general public, need to pay attention. You know, I think it's along the lines of we need to try to make sure, we need to get involved, we need to write our politicians and say, hey, like what I did, our traffic cameras, we had things called van cams being run by a private company that was obviously for profit, but they were cheating. They were putting their vans right next to, like within 10 yards of the change in speed limit on certain freeways, and they're giving people tickets. I and many others basically documented that with some very early digital cameras and posted to a website saying, hey, I don't mind these being used for safety, but I do mind you cheating. You know, they're cockroaching traffic tickets. So we, the general public, need to have oversight. We need to just make sure that the law enforcement folks are using the tools within the, within the acceptable rules of society. And we, the people, need to keep speaking. Now, sadly, that's not going to be the case in every country. You know, China obviously has a slightly different attitude on how they do things. But in so-called free society, we need to be involved with government. We need to write our legislative representatives. We need to write our mayors. We need to make our voices heard. Because, sadly, democracy is not easy. It's hard. It's advanced citizenship, and it means we have to get involved. And I think this is a really, really good place for us to make sure we're involved and make our voices heard.
Right. Yeah, I think you make a good point. I think, you know, if you think about it, you know, the Amazon is just providing a service, and, you know, whoever's willing to pay for it, in this case, not willing to pay that much. I think it's a pretty fairly inexpensive service to use this. I mean, there's many applications for this that can be used. And Curtis, I want to get your thoughts on how that applies to the enterprise. But I think one thing I'm worried about is that there can be malicious actors here, people that use this for malicious purposes. And it sounds like, you know, maybe it is time to get a little bit of regulation around it as well. But, you know, as it applies to the enterprise, there's many different applications for this, right, Curtis?
Oh, there are tons of applications for this. And I think it's appropriate that we're having this conversation today, when GDPR became the law in Europe and had an impact on companies around the world. Because one of the things that we have not yet settled is whether your face, whether your image is personally identifiable information. If it is, then there are all kinds of regulations that now apply to how it can be gathered, what can be done with it, and how it can be stored. If it is determined that your face is not personally identifiable, then the rules are much broader. I suspect, though, for business entities, we're going to see some cases where individuals or regulators really push the case that your face is approximately as personal and identifiable as your iris or your fingerprint. And as such, there are going to be some very strict rules about what can be done with it, when it can be captured, and how long that image can be saved once a corporation grabs it.
Right. Makes sense. Well, folks, we've run out of time for the bites, but before we get to my favorite part of the show where we actually bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot, we want to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, Duo. So teams always have barriers and issues with rolling out security, especially in the world of bringing your own devices to the workplace. I don't know about you, but in order to secure my tablet or phone, I'm always hesitant about installing MDM solutions on my devices. And if you think about it, this makes MDM solutions challenging to deploy. I know from experience that without MDM, sometimes you feel a little worried that you don't have any visibility into what devices are actually accessing and what data they have on it. But that's where Duo Beyond comes in and makes things simpler. Duo Beyond actually delivers mobile endpoint security and visibility with a modern, agentless alternative to traditional mobile device management solutions. Duo Beyond actually allows secure connections to all applications based on the trustworthiness of users and devices. Sontera Healthcare, as you know, is one of the largest nonprofit healthcare organizations in the nation. They went from MDM solution to Duo Beyond. They had more than 300 sites of care and over 28,000 employees across the entire system, but they easily were able to deploy Duo Beyond and instantly gain visibility into all their devices accessing the network. And as if we needed a little bit more, they were able to actually quickly deploy their access policies to secure all of their devices as well. It just proves out that Duo Beyond makes it easy to set strong mobile access policies so you can grant access when devices meet specific security requirements, regardless of where the user are or what kind of device they're using. Duo Beyond grants access to cloud and on-premise apps without those clunky old VPNs and MDM systems. With all that Duo has to offer, and now with Duo Beyond, you can literally close the loop on security in your organization. Adopt a zero trust security model today with Duo Beyond. Visit duo.com to learn more and to sign up for a free trial. That's duo.com. And we thank Duo for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we now get into my favorite part of the show, which we get to bring a guest in and talk to the Twilight Riot. And this day, today is actually no different, is that we have a great guest, Monica Jain, Chief Product Officer and co-founder of Logic Hub. We want to thank Monica for coming to This Week in Enterprise Tech. Welcome, Monica.
Hi, everyone. Hi. Thanks for having me here, Lou. I'm very excited to be here.
Thanks for coming. We're excited as well. We're talking about some pretty interesting stuff today. And I think seeing that you have just a little bit of experience in the security industry and tech, can you just maybe tell us a little bit about your journey and the tech security industry that you've been through?
Yes. So just a little bit is about 18 years. Yeah, absolutely. I have been in security for the last 18 years, and I'm just in love with security. I think I started my career right out of college and started in a company named ArcSight, which is a pioneer in the SIM market, security information event management. And since then, I fell in love with security and haven't left it since then.
Fantastic. So now you're actually with an organization called Logic Hub, and it's actually a fairly cool organization. I have seen some neat projects from them. In fact, I've personally seen Logic Hub Threat GPS, which actually goes and detect threats within source code and some things like GitHub repos. Can you tell us a little bit about Logic Hub and some of the things it focuses on?
Absolutely. So Logic Hub is a security startup focusing on security intelligence automation. So our platform is trying to automate the decision making of a security analyst when he's trying to make a decision in the security operations center. And Logic Hub Threat GPS is primarily focused on detecting, suspicious things from a particular source, such as GitHub, where we actually have expertise within the product that can actually crawl through your GitHub logs and find what is suspicious, what should you be looking at, just all in one box, and it's just ready for you to use if you don't have time and people to look at your logs.
So what kind of technology goes into that? I mean, does it have to obviously text analytics? Is there something that goes into that actually helps you determine threats in source code?
Yeah, so we actually have a team of people here who are trying to put together this expertise within the box. And the kind of technologies that we are using is obviously data analytics, like how can we, you know, how can we see something is different than normal behavior. We're also using some machine learning algorithms under the hood as a piece of the puzzle to surface some of the things that human eyes is a little harder for them to even observe that. And then combining it with the automation platform so that it can be repeated and it can do a large volume of data at a much faster speed than a human being in the picture.
Right. Under so, the hood. Go ahead.
Hmm? No, I was saying under the hood, we have all these things being under the product.
Right. So the interesting thing about this is you claim this to be an agentless deployment or installation. So can you tell us a little bit about, like, if I wanted to get started with Logic Hub and I wanted to take advantage of some of its security capabilities, what do I have to do to do that?
So there are a couple of options. One, when we are working with the large enterprises, they usually prefer on-prem solution because they don't want data to leave at all. And so in that particular case, we have an appliance for them. We can also, give a software binary to them that they can install on their own hardware that they trust and procure within the company. There are customers who also prefer cloud-based installments where we actually segregate their instance in our cloud environment and then make it available to them where they can just access the product via a web UI from there. So we have both options available. And typically what I've seen in larger enterprises, on-prem is very successful. And in medium-sized companies, they are more prone towards cloud-based deployment that we have.
Got it. So the interesting thing about this is that obviously not all organizations are created equal. So they have different automation chains and workflows. And this is particularly a platform, right? Can they actually alter the platform, in a kind of a white box fashion to make it more useful for them?
Yes. So I think that's the premise of Logic Hub, because I have been in security for last 18 years and I used to manage ArcSight ESM product, which was the pioneer or market leader for 10 years in security information event management market. And what I learned during that experience is every time we went to a larger enterprise or even a mid-sized customer, each environment is so different that you cannot say that, hey, I have something out of the box and it will just work magically in your environment. I have seen it firsthand. I have done my own hands-on experience with them. It just doesn't work like that. So every environment is different. It has to be customized. It has to be tailored to what is important to you. That is why when we started Logic Hub from the ground up, we have tried to make the platform flexible in a way that it can be customized to your environment in a quick and easy fashion. We kind of call it like Lego framework, where we have all the key Legos in the picture or on the available on the platform, and you can quickly put together which Lego applies to your environment and bring it to a state which is useful to you as your use cases and pain points are there.
Makes sense. And then does this also let you integrate into other systems within your organization as well, so that you can customize kind of the workflow where the data comes from, as well as how the system actually generates threat ranking and so on?
Absolutely. So I think Logic Hub is a combination of data analysis and some operators which are based on machine learning, plus integration with a lot of other tools that are already deployed in your environment. And we bring all these three things together to combine and correlate what is important and then make a decision at the end with the analyst, right? So as part of this flow that we are building, we do integrate with a lot of tools that are already being deployed and that are part of your workflow when you are trying to triage a particular alert to make a decision. So that is absolutely there. We are already integrating with tons of tools. I think every customer we reach out to, we will always find something new that is homegrown, they have built internally, is not available on the market. So we have built this framework in such a manner that it's flexible, and it takes us like probably 1 to 2 days to just bring that integration and make it live for the customer.
Makes sense. So because we have multiple topics today to talk with you, I wanted to also bring my co-host back in because they're actually talking about some stuff here in the chat and they want to ask some questions. Cheeber, you wanted to ask a question about Logic Hub?
Actually, I want to ask for you to set the Wayback Machine a little bit. When I first met you when I was working with Oliver Rist on the Security Event Manager article for InfoWorld quite a few years ago. It was breathtaking at how far the industry had come. One of the key things that we heard in all the presentations from the vendors was people still aren't giving enough personnel. Security has always been shorthanded. Mm-hmm. This is almost feeling like the next generation. Mm-hmm. Are you starting to see that?
Absolutely. I think you have it right on the spot, right? So what I have seen in this industry, and honestly, going back with you, back in 2000s, we started very well with collection, right? We started collecting data from different sources. We moved on to detection with SIEM technologies like ArcSight, Splunk, QRadar out there. And we started, working on these alerts. But what ends up happening is our alerts are constantly increasing day by day. Right, with the large volume of data, with the openness to cloud, with so many applications being deployed, it is not going down and it's not going to go down even in future, right? It's always increasing. But when I look at my customers, and I'm very close to my customers, I have been working with them for years, their teams who are responsible to look at these alerts, they haven't grown. At any, if I look at them, they were probably at 15 back then, and they're probably at like 20 to 25 by now, right? And the reason is because even if they want to grow, there is a shortage of skill set, right? Especially in security industry. So not only they cannot hire, even if they hire, they cannot retain them because there are very few experts in the market. There is a lot of work to be done and a lot of data has to be processed. So I don't think that was a premise for Logic Hub, but after 15 years, I said it has to be, automation has to come and help them because we cannot find enough human beings to put it on this problem and try to solve it because we don't have that many skill set people in the market. So I agree with you 100%. And I think that is actually one of the key drivers why these kind of technologies like Logic Hub are important and absolutely needed to attack this problem of large number of alerts and how can we make this alert triage process more efficient? How can we help them make decisions faster to do their job so that they cannot, not only worry about false positives, which is a benefit, but they also are worried about false negatives. How can we enable them to do their job in such a way that they have time to look at these important things, right? And weed away the mundane and repetitive tasks from their day-to-day job. Yeah, I agree with you. Absolutely.
So I actually see Curtis in the chat here chomping at the bit. I'm going to throw it to him because I think he has some questions as well.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Kurt.
Hi there. Well, I think my question is going to be around one of the drivers because I hear a lot of people, and you're one of them, say that it's the lack of people that's the one of the drivers. We simply have done a very bad job of turning out all of the security professionals we really need to keep up. I think my question, though, on the automation level is whether we could ever bring up enough people to deal with it, or have we hit a point where things simply move so rapidly that automation is the only chance to keep up regardless of how many people are on our security teams?
Right. And I think that's a great question. And I have been, observing this as well for many years. To answer your question, I don't think that we can solve this problem just by banking on people. And the reason I think is also in your question is because we have reached that point. We have reached that point where data is totally out of control, and the impact of that is you are suspicious. Your suspicious activities are hiding in your environment somewhere, right? And humanly, I do not think we can reach there, even if we had more people, because what happens is you do need people to handle these alerts. However, at the same time, you do need powerful techniques under the hood or automation to do certain things that they can do repetitively and get them there so that they can at least look at these alerts and say, I have looked at least 90% of my data. Today, I think if you ask anybody, I don't think they can, you know, confidently say that I have looked at least, like, let's say, even 80% of the data or 70% of their data, because they just can't. Data is completely out of control right now. I don't think there is, I think automation is a must right now in the industry. No matter what level you apply it, I think you have to start there and continue from there. One of the points you had, right, that how can human do what we are trying to do with machines at this point? And I think one of the things that came to my mind later on is that even if I try to do that, security is one area where the domain expertise comes with the years of experience. So while we can wait for that to happen for, you know, a larger, set there, in the meantime, what we could do is learn from the experts that are already there. That's what we are trying to do at Logic Hub. And then, you know, replicate it via machines and create those virtual analysts sort of people, right? And who can actually mimic what the experts are doing and trying to recommend to junior guys to say, hey, you know, this is how you should triage this alert. And this is how you should surface these critical incidents and out there.
No, and I think that's a really good point. I've been talking to a lot of people, especially the last 3 or 4 months, about how they're using automation. And I think just about everyone agrees that the best way to use it is to augment the skills and abilities of the human analysts rather than having us worry about humans being replaced by automation.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah.
So I think that, you know, to me that's where different groups are going to come up with different solutions, because you can have some genuine discussion about precisely what part of the total job is best automated and what part is best left to humans. And right. And so I think that's where we're going to see some creative solutions over the next probably 2 or 3 years.
And I do a lot of talks at B-Sides, and every time I get this question, are you going to replace human beings or analysts? And I always tell them that it's, you know, I mean, we can't do our job without you, right? So we need human people, we need human intelligence, and of course, we want to augment, right, what they are trying to do and actually reshift their focus to other important things, so that we can automate the stuff that we already know and they can start looking at newer things that require more skilled people like them. So I agree with that. I think same observation. And Logic Hub is going through that route at this point.
Fantastic. Well, we're talking with Monica Jane about Logic Hub. But when we come back, we have another topic about in technology. But first, we want to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And this time, it's Rocket Mortgage. So, you know, this is one of the America's largest mortgage lenders. J.D. Power even rated Quicken Loans the highest in customer satisfaction this past year. Rocket Mortgage is really solving a real-world problem for buyers and sellers today. What Quicken Loans and Rocket Mortgage realized is it isn't easy to do refis or financing a new loan. The process is really far behind the times here. For me, it actually took a pound of papers, a staple couldn't even go through the papers, and hours of my time I could never, ever get back, ever again. And I was assigned some random rep from a bank that would leverage messaging to actually ask for me for more data, and I had a search for all that data in my cabinets and boxes, but... And by the way, like, I couldn't actually email that information to them. I actually had to fax it into them. It was super stressful. And that's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. They're super simple. They reinvented the process so you don't have to waste your time. You don't have to stress about it. It allows you to buy a house of your dreams without all that red tape. You don't have to go to the bank. You can do it on any one of your devices, just with anyone that has a browser. And all you have to do is go rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. You spend a couple of minutes of your time. They barely ask you any questions. They ask you things that you already know. No searching for the answers. They ask you things like your name, your address, the type of loan, the property, what you'll be using it for, purchase price, the type, and the rate. And that's it. because Quicken Loans has partnerships with all the big financial institutions. They do the rest. They get all the information they need to find the loan for you. And you choose the right rate for you, the term, and they show you the loans you're qualified for, all in just a couple minutes. Nowadays, the housing market is going crazy, especially here in the Seattle area. And I've been at open houses where someone actually literally had to put an offer right there in order to even be in the running for that property. It's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That is rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, and MLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. We thank Rocket Mortgage for making This Week in Enterprise Tech possible. Well, we've been talking with Monica Jain, Chief Product Officer, co-founder of Logic Hub. And we've been talking a little bit about Logic Hub, but we want to switch gears a little bit here. And we want to talk about something that you're also passionate about and also been involved in, and that's Women in IT Awards. And what I've seen is there's been many talk about this amazing program in the wild. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about the program and how you're involved.
Sure. I think Women in IT Awards is definitely a wonderful program encouraging women across technology and bringing all of them together to identify the role models and sometimes even encourage younger women to determine what they want to do with their careers and how others have gone through their journey and what worked for them and what didn't. And I think it's a wonderful way for younger women and even, other women out there to come and meet with very, very talented, women across the world and be in the same room, talking to them and sharing knowledge and learning from each other. So I would highly encourage anyone who is trying to be in IT or have been in IT for a long time to come and mentor others and help each other.
Absolutely. So, there is a growing effort for employers and educators and government alike where they're looking to be more inclusive and close that gender gap. However, looking at the data, I'm seeing female participation still remains fairly low. I saw some data recently that said in the UK, there's only 16% of IT jobs are actually occupied by women. By doing these awards, does it help focus and help actually promote women who are not only in the industry, but also evolving the industry in order to get more people excited about, coming into the industry?
I absolutely believe that. I think once I got involved and, they announce everywhere the awards and everything, I do get pinged by younger women, and especially when I met with them there, they were thinking about it and they were like, how did you go into this and what can we do? How can we get started? And I think it's amazing to see that it's really, I felt like it's probably easier, but it doesn't seem like that easy. I think people are trying to get in there, especially women, but they do not know where to start. Right? How to go about it? Who should I talk to? Am I okay to go about it? Right? So sometimes they even, question themselves, like, is it something for me or not? And I usually tell them that, it's about following your own passion. And if you are passionate about it, then it's about finding the right path to get there. And you have to be surrounded by good people to support you, to mentor you, and to show you the right path to get you there.
Absolutely. So one of the interesting things, I started looking into the awards a little bit, and there are some focus areas that it focuses on, like cloud and change management and so on and so forth. Can you kind of give us some areas of that it focuses on and why you guys chose, why the awards actually chose those areas?
So I think they're primarily focused on IT, and they pick, different areas of focus so that different verticals or industry can see women in that particular area. For example, for security, they have security champion of the year, future CISO of the year, or, CIO of the year. And I think for entrepreneurship, they actually try to bring in, young women who has started their companies and who has, have done their great in their businesses. So I think it's all about, trying to give different flavors of achievements to younger women so that they can see and talk to those other women and see and learn from them, right, depending on their interests. So I think that's how they break it down and try to pull in women from these different areas together.
Absolutely. So, you know, I'm sure the audience would love to hear. I'm sure you probably have some maybe past stories about some of the finalists and winners. Do you maybe have some stories about them and maybe what areas they're in?
Yeah, I think one of the categories I was chosen there as well. And I think when I looked at other, finalists all over, I think I was pretty, I would say much, happy. I think I would say like, oh my God, like these women have achieved so much, right? So some of them were CISOs, some of them were entrepreneurs, some of them were, trying to do, great in their larger organizations, although they don't have like entrepreneurship or things, but they're doing wonderful in their businesses, right? So I think this is, I met many of them there and it's amazing, when you come out there and you see like if they can do it, I think any women can do it.
Right. So I've heard a little bit about Future Stars of Tech, which targets grads in the beginning of their career. Now, how is this kind of related to the award program?
So I think they pretty much go after younger women and see if they are doing great in their colleges, they're doing great in their early jobs, and trying to, at least flourish a little bit more from there on, and then figure out how can we help them and give them more guidance around that. I think that's the whole idea there.
Speaking of younger women, I work at a university and I teach. Right now I push my female students towards Women in Technology International, WETI.org. And what would you give as far as sage advice to my young students that are coming up?
I think I would tell them, and I used to be there at some point, and I always, I was a minority, right, versus other women who would try to do something, and I would like, no, I want to do technology, computer science, engineering. I would say, the only thing I would say is follow your passion. If you are passionate about technology, if you are passionate about coding, if you are passionate about security, don't step back. You need to step forward and keep following your passion. One thing will lead to another thing. Have confidence in yourself that you can do it and then keep moving forward. I think the path will automatically become clear to you. But you have to have that drive to move forward. You have to have that, I would say, the hunger to get there and to follow your passion all the way and not give up for any challenges that come in the way.
Got it. Now, Curtis, you also had some questions. I see you asking in the chat room here.
Absolutely. And Monica, mine comes around this notion of the path that you're talking about. It seems to me in talking to many young women in the field that one of the obstacles might be this very narrow definition we have of the path to technology positions or the path into a role within a technology company. Do you think that we need to, as both individuals and organizations, broaden our notion of what can be a reasonable path into the initial mm-hmm. positions?
Right.
Do we need to look at that for women, but for really everyone?
Mm-hmm. Right. And I absolutely think we have to. I think we still have to do a lot more work there. Brian was saying earlier, young women in the college, right? I think the biggest challenge we have right now is the lack of exposure. Right. Even though women are talented, even though they think they can do much great in technology, but they do not get that opportunity or exposure to even try it out. Right. And see if they like it. I think STEM is picking up. I see even in schools now. Right. Younger girls are introduced to STEM programs and they are trying to, code right now in 7th, 6th grades, right? And they're just getting exposed. And my daughter is also trying to code right now. And she's like, Mama, I love it. And I'm like, you should pursue it further, right? So if they do not get exposure, they don't even sometimes realize that it is in them and it is something that they can pursue further. So I think I agree with you. I think the first thing to paint that path for them is to give them the exposure. And if they are passionate about it, then you have to give them the support to follow that passion all the way, right? Whether it's in college or school or even in the industry, right? That if they are capable, we should give them the support to grow into that role, even if they are not there today. And I think eventually, results is the primary thing that they should focus on, because even if they're given the exposure and the support, if they do not produce results, they will stop right there, right? So they need to take that ownership that, hey, if I'm given a chance, I will be equally, you know, I'll produce even better results compared to my colleagues, right? So that hard work and determination has to be there. And then I think it will line up. That path will become clear after that. So I do think those three areas, we need to work more on both ends, from the women perspective and from society perspective.
Right. So, Monica, unfortunately, we're running out of time, but I do want to give you the last word here, maybe to talk a little bit about, you know, if anybody wants to get involved in the program, or maybe even check out the program, the past winners, or even the runners up, the finalists here that are coming up, where can they go and how can they get involved?
I think they have event organizers. I think in my case, probably what happened is they reached out. You know, they also handpick, by the way. They also keep an eye on, you know, industry and see women who are out there. And they ask for submission. And I think we wrote what we have done in the past and, you know, submit it. And then it goes from there. But the other way could also be, you know, reach out to them directly and, you know, using their contacts and say, hey, I want to get involved either as, you know, attendee or, hey, I want to, you know, I'm interested in one of these categories. And I think it can go from there as well.
Great, great. Well, folks, you've done it again. You've wasted another hour with the best dang enterprise tech show, according to 9 out of 10 GDPR data points. But I first want to thank our guest, Monica Jane, Chief Product Officer and co-founder. Can you tell us a little bit about where they can find you and your work, a little bit of LogicHap and so on?
Absolutely. I think I would encourage everyone out there who are chartered to look at their alerts every single day to find out or make decisions if it's okay or not. Call me, text me. My email is monica@logichub.com and ask me or challenge me, how can you automate my thinking, my intuition, and my decision making? And we will make it happen for you for sure.
Fantastic. That was Monica Jane from LogicHub. Monica, thank you so much for joining this week in Enterprise Tech. It's been great conversing with you, some great topics, and we thank you for coming on.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you for having me here. Thank you.
Of course, folks, I want to thank my co-hosts in crime, and they make the show possible, and they make it fun, starting with Mr. Brian Chi. Brian, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you, your work, and how they can get in touch with you about show?
On Twitter, I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, or I am Chebert, Cheebert, at twit.tv. Would love to hear from you on show topics. And, you know, some of the best show topics have come from you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chebert. I definitely want to thank the amazing Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you, your work, and what you've been up to?
Well, you can always find me at Dark Reading, and you can find me pointing to my stuff at Dark Reading in my Twitter account, KG4GWA. Would love to know what you think of my articles. Give me some ideas for new articles if you'd like. I'm always fascinated by new technologies, new situations out there, and the new ways in which people are using them. So please feel free to reach out and touch me on Twitter. Would love to start the conversation.
Thanks, guys. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. I especially want to thank Leo and Lisa, who's supported us each and every week to continue to do this week in Enterprise Tech. Thank you to all the engineers. Thank you to Mr. Brian Chi for being our tireless producer. Always definitely hit him up on Twitter for any show notes or show options or guests on this week in Enterprise Tech. Of course, Coast, I also want to thank you, because each and every week you tune in to watch the show or listen to the show, and we want to make it easy for you to do so. So go right now. twit.tv/Twyatt. You can find all the back episodes, the show notes, the guest information, links to all the stories during the show. And more importantly, next to the videos up there, there's that magic button. Subscribe to the format of your choice, whether it's audio, video, HD audio, video, and to the device of your choice, phone, tablet, laptop, desktop. And remember always that we do this show live each and every week on Fridays at 1:30 Pacific time. You can check us out live at live.twit.tv. And of course, if you want to jump in and watch the show live, you might as well jump into the chat room as well. That's irc.twit.tv. The show really becomes more rich when we talk to the chat room. We get some questions, we get conversations, we talk to the guests. It's been really great having the chat room there. So thank you to the chat room. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter, LouMM. And you can find all the things that I'm working on there, as well as don't forget to check out dev.office.com. That's all the work that I'm doing at Microsoft about extending and making Office work better for you and your organization. Also, I want to thank our TD today. Kevin, can you tell the folks at home what it is you actually do at Twit?
I rotate between drinking light roast coffee, dark roast coffee, coffee with cream, black coffee, and espresso. Yeah.
That's all I do. We know that the coffee is the fuel of the gods. So I think that that helps you, Kevin, for sure.
Yep, totally.
Thank you, Kevin. We hope to see you next week. Until next time, I'm Lou Smoreska saying, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Jeez.